Hey everybody, this is the Brew Shaman for Crafted For You, and with me tonight is Chris Nielsen.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Unfortunately, Alyssa couldn't be here tonight. She's a little under the weather.
Boo.
But we are here with the owners of the Fainting Goat Distillery here in Greensboro, North Carolina. If you'd like to introduce yourselves.
I'm Bill.
I'm Andrew.
Easy enough.
Again, we crushed
easy
it.
Enough. You guys are killing it.
Just
you killed it in the sound check. So, like I said, we're here in Greensboro. This is the only distillery here in Greensboro.
And Guilford County.
Only one
and
in
Guilford
County.
Legal, at least.
Yeah.
As far as we know.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's only one in Winston. And
there's two in Winston.
There's two in Winston.
Settlers and Broad Branch.
Cool. I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the first question that I want to ask you guys, since you're the first distillery we've had on, is how did you start doing this?
Were you a cop?
How does one start a distillery?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's illegal to make any kind of spirit unless you have a distilled spirit permit from the government.
Right.
So even making it for your own self is highly illegal. Had we, in fact, done that on our own for the last 4 or 5 years, theoretically, yeah. Theoretically, let's say for the last 4 or 5 years, we knew about 8 years ago we wanted to start a distillery.
Okay.
And so about 4 years ago, we really got serious about it and started making sure that we knew what we were doing, first and foremost. Then we started all of the application process with the government, which is about a 2-year process. And so we've been working on that for the last couple of years. We got our CO here about 6 weeks ago. So we started making vodka and gin and whiskey. We can't bottle anything yet. We're still waiting on label approval. But we're making product now, and as soon as our labels are approved, which should be within the next couple of weeks, it'll be in the ABC stores, and then we'll be able to take a tour here and do a tasting.
Nice. Sorry. So, yeah, we are in your tasting room. So this will be open to the public and everything.
It will.
And how often are you guys going
to
be open?
So we'll do tours several times a week.
Okay.
We'll always be open with the garage door open, talking to people when they come in and things like that. We'll do official tours and tastings. By law, we can't do a tasting unless there's an official tour given.
Right.
And we can't do that for free either, which they kind of mandate on us. So what we'll do is we'll do it several times a week. We haven't scratched out the exact times yet.
Uh-huh.
But you can come in, do a tour, learn about the process, taste everything, and just kind of enjoy it at that point.
We know that we'll be open probably Tuesday through Saturday,
mm-hmm.
10 to 7-ish kind of thing, and probably Fridays and Saturdays we'll have designated tours, like on the hour or whatever. But if somebody stops in and says, hey, I'd love to try your product, give me $10, I'd be happy to let you. You can walk through and I'll let you sample it.
We're nice that way.
Yeah. And we love to talk about ourselves.
Yeah.
So that's easy.
Yeah.
That's easy.
Unfortunately for us, by North Carolina law, we can't do cocktails or set up like a bar or anything like
that.
Yeah. So the tours and tastings are really what we're kind of limited to, but we're excited about them.
So we did a podcast here a couple of months ago, not here, but next door when you guys were still setting up.
Oh, nice.
Do you guys plan on doing any like collaboration with Gibbs?
We have, yeah. I mean, they have been nothing but absolutely awesome to us. We've worked hand in hand with them. You know, they've helped out lending forklifts, whatever they need. It's awesome to share a wall with somebody who shares a similar passion for a pretty, really similar product. You guys are out there and see, you know, we kind of take beer to a different level. So we love to learn about their process. They love to learn about ours, as well as we'll definitely do some stuff in the future. My big thing is I really want to take one of their beers and make a hopped whiskey out of it.
Yeah.
That's kind of the thing where I'm looking forward to the most. So we definitely talked to them about that. I'm sure they'll use some of our used barrels for some of the beers and everything like that. There's definitely a huge partnership with Gibbs, with the brewers in Greensboro in general have reached out to us. They've been phenomenal with us. Incredibly nice. Love the process and love to work hand in hand with us.
That sounds awesome.
That's super great.
Excited.
Yeah,
I'm excited for this whole little area
coming up
here.
And we can also do some things with wineries. We've been approached by a couple of wineries as well because we can take their low wines, their grape juice,
mm-hmm.
and we can turn that into then liquor, into grappa.
Yeah.
It really is the same process. We're taking the sugar and converting that sugar to alcohol. Those kinds of things, if they can ever get the law, what the law says right now is you can, if you come in to take a tour and a tasting, you can purchase one bottle per person per year directly from us. Everything else will have to go through the ABC store. So you can buy one bottle per person per year. the law, they're looking at changing the law where it will be one bottle per person per year of each product that we make.
Right.
That will allow us to make 300 or 400 bottles of something that would only be available here, rather than having to make 2,500 for the ABC stores.
Absolutely.
Then we could start doing small projects.
A little bit more like what a brewery would do.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
So I don't see a big challenge to that law yet.
Is that a state law or a federal law?
That's a state law.
That's a state law? Okay.
Yes.
So is that something other states have, or are we kind of...
Well, there are five or six control states, and we're one of those control states. They just passed a law in Kentucky where if you go in, like currently you can go in and buy a case of liquor while you're there at the distillery for a tour, but they just passed a law where they can also sell mixed drinks at the distillery.
Yeah.
So I think as the state realizes the huge benefit tax-wise and tourism-wise, because it's a pretty highly taxed product for the
state.
One
of the highest in the country.
Oh, yeah, and they want us to be successful. They want to have our products in the store, in their ABC stores. So the state has also been, the ABC board has been very, very supportive of what we're doing as well, because they are invested in our success.
Yeah. That's good. That seems like it would be a tough relationship to maintain on the outside, because it seems like, you know, they're a regulatory agency and you guys are making a product that is heavily regulated, and I'm glad to hear that they're helping you guys.
And each state, you know, once we've traveled and gone to other distilleries and gone to classes and whatnot, we, you know, each state has some very specific laws about liquor, and you have a producer, you have a distributor, and you have a retailer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at least in North Carolina, our distributor is the state, and they're the retailer as well.
Right.
So we're dealing with one person who, again, is invested in our success. So at least we know kind of what devil we're dancing with.
They're incentivized to put the bottles at the front for us to sell well. You know, they love North Carolina products.
Absolutely.
Not only are we made here, our grain is from here, everything is North Carolina.
Yeah. So it's a whole economy, not just...
Exactly. Oh, yeah. So they're welcome to sell it, and they definitely get their money's worth out of the taxes from the bottles. So
that's
they're
true.
Happy to do it.
And even when we talk about our grain, you know, we're using 600 pounds of North Carolina grain every single day.
Yeah.
One run that we do is 600 pounds of grain,
and
we do that every single day. So we had a farmer near Salisbury. Where was he from?
He's in Marshfield, outside of Monroe.
Outside of Monroe. You know, he dropped off 12,000 pounds.
Yeah, 12,000.
12,000 pounds of grain today. He was smiling when he left.
Yeah, I'm sure he was.
Yeah.
That's why we have grain just sitting everywhere out there right now. We're just trying to raise it, but it's taking up everything right now.
Mm-hmm.
We got some mashing to do.
We do indeed.
That's great. You guys want to talk us through the process a little bit, since most of our listeners probably aren't super familiar with the way they
Well, I can talk about the mash. We kind of break the process up into two parts. I tend to do the mash, and he distills it into alcohol.
Okay.
So I was an executive chef for 18 years,
so
cooking that mash is something I understand.
Yeah.
So we get our grain in whole, and we do that because we can guarantee the freshness of it. When that grain comes in, you know that it's good, fresh grain. We take it, hammer mill it down. Use 600 pounds at a time and put it into a mash tun, a cooker. It's just a big steam jacketed vessel. Part of that grain is malted, which means it has an enzyme in it that converts starch to sugar. So it's about a 5.5 hour process to go from start to finish. And by the end, although it's just flour and water, it tastes like breakfast cereal. It's so sweet.
Right.
We then take that mash. We're going to move it to a fermenter. Chill it back down to about 95 degrees, and then we will add yeast to it and some nutrients and allow that to ferment. So the yeast eats the sugar, produces alcohol out the back end, and that's about a 3.5-4 day process.
Mm-hmm.
We should get about a 12% alcohol by volume, meaning if I put in 300 gallons in there, then I should get 12% of that out in alcohol for every run. And each spirit that we produce gin, we produce vodka, we produce a single malt whiskey, rye whiskey, and bourbon. Each one of those is simply a different mash bill, a different recipe of ratios of grain to get a very specific flavor.
Yeah, and then we put it into the still. I take his mash, put it in the still, pretty much just boil it. The reasoning behind that is alcohol will vaporize at a different point than water.
Yeah.
So water's at 212, alcohol, depends on what you're doing, is around 170. So that's when we start separating the actual alcohol vapors from the water vapors. Depending on what we make, it depends on where it goes in our still system. So the whiskey column goes, or the whiskey goes through a whiskey column, which is about four plates. So it distills four different times. You're reaching for the
beer. I found
the
beer.
So that comes out of lower proof. I like it about 140 is where we start taking it off. That's where we get a lot of the most flavor from.
Right.
That really combines well with the wood. The vodka and gin go through our 16-plate vodka column, which we mismeasured a little bit. If you guys, I think you guys saw it out there, we're about 3 feet past the roof.
Yeah.
Like a church steeple.
It is like a church steeple. But then we run through there. That's when we distill it through the 16-plate, so we get it to up to 190 proof, which by law it has to be. About, I think the last statistic was 70% of craft distillers don't do that process. They just buy it wholesale, like in a big tanker truck. So it's really important to us to do that.
Oh, wow.
To kind of run it through
there.
And overall, 90% of the vodka that's on the market is simply grain neutral spirits that you purchase somewhere. There's a couple of places. Indiana, Lawrenceville, Indiana, at MGP, is the biggest producer of contracted spirits for people. And it's something that's been done forever. I mean, it's no secret about how they do it. You know, and distillers will buy from other distillers and contract with other distillers. Yeah. But it's not, you know, we could buy a 300-gallon tote of grain neutral spirits, which is distilled to 190 proof, for about $1,500. It takes us about $4,500 to make that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we can go to Google Earth and watch our wheat grow. We know when they put fertilizer on it. We know, we know the farmer who brings it in. So from start to finish, we know every part of that, that process of what we're doing.
From that, depending on what we do, so the gin will go through a gin basket. So it's pretty much, I call it a minion head, just stacked full of botanicals, the juniper, the coriander, the cardamom, cucumber, tons of different stuff in there.
Orange.
Really give away the entire recipe.
Oh, sorry.
They have it now.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't say lemongrass.
And then it all comes out the condenser. And so the condenser is pretty much just, it's called shotgun condenser. So it's just cold water piping. And so when the alcohol hits it, the water shocks it back down into a liquid, and that's when it comes out, the white liquid that you see. And then depending on, you know, whiskey, we obviously put in the barrels, and the rest we proof down with our reverse osmosis water that we make on site to the drinkable 80 proof, 90 proof, whatever you're drinking.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's a lot like brewing.
Yeah.
Most of it is, except we don't want to mill it down into flour.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
One of the few things that...
Yeah.
It is, and it's unusual for people who understand beer to come in and see our process, because they go, it's dark and murky, and I believe I see a fly in there. Yeah, and that's just kind of the way it's done. All of ours
That'll
are open-top containers, and in beer, you want it to be clear. And
you don't want anything touching anything.
That's exactly right.
We just want to get the starch out of it, so we expose it. That's why I make it with flour, so we expose the starch as much as possible.
Is that why you do that?
You want every bit of sugar out of that as you can.
Exactly.
With beer, you're wasting a lot.
Exactly.
You want... You're getting your money's worth.
For you, clarity is important and things like that. For us, it just looks like a murky creek when we're done. It looks like old bathwater.
Yeah.
It'll eventually get clear.
It's a great way. Let's put that on the bottle.
That's not a good marketing tool.
The open top, though? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
I prefer the open top fermentation. To me, instead of closing it off, because like you said, with the beer, we don't have to worry about that much. We distill it, so we kind of take it all out of there. To me, I like it because you can only do this at this location.
Yeah.
So we get certain wild yeast in the air that you can only get here that you can't get 3 miles down the road.
Right.
We'll get some stuff floating over from Gibbs that will go in there and just make, you know, somewhat of a small difference that we like, and it's just incredibly local for us.
And there's it produces CO2, so there's about an inch on the top of it of CO2 that keeps things from... The bad bacteria, things like that, from getting in it. But it is unique to, I don't mean unique to us like nobody else does it. It's unique to us that only in this location are you going to get all of these factors coming together to produce what it is that's here naturally. It's in these old bricks.
Oh, these old bricks.
And it may be in some of these old bricks.
Yeah, that's really cool.
This place is awesome.
This place is this tasting room, I guess, right? It's not a tap room. There's no taps.
Yeah,
right.
This is a cool place. I like the brick walls and the copper pipes.
Yeah, we were really lucky to find this location. It's, you know, and it's a great end of Greensboro where it's really up and coming, and it's the right crowd for us that comes over here. It's and the city of Greensboro has really embraced us as well as the first and only distillery.
Yeah.
You know, we ran a commercial last Super Bowl for Fainting Goat Spirits, And people tell me that they were in a bar and the commercial came on and everybody, first of all, goats just kind of started walking into a bar. So everybody stopped and looked and went, what the hell is going on here? And when they put up the words Greensboro Distilling opening soon, they said the entire bar just erupted of people excited.
That's
and
awesome.
Owning it, taking ownership in it, that it's part of Greensboro.
That's cool. Have you guys noticed a, because like in craft beer over the past few years, we've had a big culture shift. As beer becomes a little bit more, I don't know, family friendly, a little bit less about just like getting hammered and watching football. You know, does it feel like kind of craft distilling becoming a thing? You sort of feel that cultural shift too?
I definitely see that. It's not just hard liquor gets a bad rap too.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't like it and it's attributed to a lot of things.
Right.
So we definitely see that. A lot of people, and I 100% take it. I think it's from the craft beer movement. Mm-hmm. You know, you people are you people. there's
that
people. There's people out there who I grew up with the craft beer movement. I loved it. I was huge into craft beer, big homebrewer as well. And that's what turned into this.
Yeah.
Is I was homebrewer. I was like, well, what else can I do with it?
Oh, yeah. Boy, oh, there's another.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
And so you see people just never cared about beer, and all of a sudden, like when I was at UNC Charlotte, I used to go to Flying Saucer.
Mm-hmm.
There was like nobody there, and then every year I go back, it just goes bigger and bigger and bigger. And now every grandmas are doing craft beer. You're not anything unless you do craft beer. So it's fun. We're kind of, I don't want to say copying that movement in that way, but a lot of
definitely drawing inspiration from.
Absolutely,
it.
It's fun.
And I think there's the same appreciation for the alcohol that's being made, for the spirits that are being made, than there is for the alcohol for the beer as well. People appreciate the fact that you are using whole grains and you know where your grain is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as you begin to, people that are really passionate about crafted spirits understand the difference in what we're doing and what other places are doing to produce it. And there's a ritual, there's a passion to spirits, and to be able to come in and just watch it being made, watching the alcohol in those bubble plates just moving up, and at the end of it, that spirit coming out the end. There's the people just appreciate what it is that you do.
I think a lot of that is too because it's a product that people are willing to spend a little bit of money on when they don't necessarily have much disposable income. And like with what you guys are doing, if I'm going to go to the ABC store and spend more money on a bottle of liquor,
and
then,
please do,
appreciate that.
Then it's nice to know where all of that's going. It's nice to know that staying local.
Yeah.
It's nice to know that
it's
supporting the community.
And not just local in Greensboro, but in North Carolina. I mean, I can't stress enough about the using all of this grain from all of these farmers. And we didn't really realize the impact we were going to have at first until just talking with this farmer today when he delivered this grain to us and said, well, can we have a conversation about what the rest of the year and maybe next year will look like?
Yeah.
And I said, hey, this is 3.5 weeks worth of grain. He said, what? we need to see you again in a month. He was ecstatic.
It was cool
because
he pulled up with his son too.
Oh,
he was probably 10 or something.
Yeah.
Hanging around, watched the process, helped his dad unload and everything like that.
Yeah,
it's just
great.
Cool.
That's
experience.
Great.
I think that's a great thing that you guys are using everything local, because like now the state government's going to see that. Us brewers are doing the same thing, you guys are doing the same thing, and maybe we can change some laws to make things a little easier on everybody.
Yeah.
I think it's a good thing for everyone.
How much inspiration do you guys draw? Because I was looking at like the branding on your bottles and stuff, and I was wondering, how much inspiration do you guys draw from the craft movement as opposed to the more of the mountain roots of distilling? Because you obviously got like wood panel and brick. It feels like a distillery, but it also feels like a bar too. I know there's a bit of a negative connotation sometimes.
I think we're more craft distillers than we are mountain moonshine.
Okay.
I think there's nothing wrong with moonshine. I mean, North Carolina makes a lot of good moonshine. This is a more refined animal that we've got here, and I think it is more about playing with the big boys, being competitive with the big boys, but on a craft level. I think that's the biggest difference.
Absolutely.
That I see. Because we'll start in 211, ABC stores when we first
have
our product.
That's amazing.
And we want to be successful in North Carolina. That is important for us. But that won't sustain our growth in the future to be just in North Carolina. So we've had conversation with people in China and in Italy who are gaga over southern American
spirits.
Bourbons
yeah.
and spirits.
Yeah.
And so I think that's sort of the direction that we're heading with our product.
Right.
Because we definitely draw a lot of inspiration from Southern things.
Yeah.
There's nothing better in the world than Southern whiskey. To me, personally, just there's not. And so we love that, and we want to bring that to it. That's why
say something good about Tennessee whiskey. Go ahead.
But even like our gin is kind of got some Southern influence on it. You know, we try to pull some from stuff from around here as much as possible. So it's just something we kind of play on. But
and the smoked
whiskeys. Yeah, like smoked. So right now we're playing with a smoked whiskey. It's kind of like our play on a scotch. So instead, it's a smoked single malt whiskey. So just like scotch. But instead of smoking with peat moss, which they do, we're going to try to do more of a barbecue flavor to it. So we're going to smoke with like hickory and oak.
Yeah,
And
kind of like a southern scotch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to also play on adding some wood flavorings to it as well. We're looking at some fruit woods like apple or peach or something to kind of throw in there.
Oh.
Just kind of see it. So we've got to experiment with
whiskeys. Because whiskeys are different. So for vodka, for bourbon and for rye whiskey, they all have to be a brand new barrel. You can only use it once. It has to sit for a certain number of years. Whiskey itself has no sort of legality terms to it like that. So we'll put it in a barrel, but we can also add things into the barrel. So that's where we would put
that. Or use next sherry berry. That's the elevator lady, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
That's exactly right. Like wine barrels, ex bourbon barrels, everything like that.
Yeah.
Our own.
The wine would be cool.
Yeah.
I like
and
that idea.
We also have an importer's license that we got with our DSP.
Yeah.
So once we're rolling, then we can import rums and tequilas, and then we can start using our old bourbon barrels since we can't reuse them for bourbon or rye whiskey and store tequila in a Fainting Goat Spirit bourbon barrel and see what we get out of it. We're working with a group out of Haiti that makes an absolutely fantastic rum that we would hope to import and be able to put our spin on what that rum is.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, and I think once you start playing around with stuff, we'll be doing absinthe and really a lot
some
of
plum brandies, Christmas whiskeys, some stuff.
Talk to Scott Christoffel at Natty's.
Really?
For absinthe. Yeah, for real. He makes his own.
Yeah? Mm. Really?
Does he?
Oh, God.
That's amazing.
It'll knock you on your ass.
I made my own in college one time. Me and my roommate. It did not turn out well.
It's awesome.
Well, that's exciting. I'll check that out.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys feel like there's a level of separation between you and the consumer because you have to go through the ABC store, or do you guys feel like you have a pretty firm grasp on being able to kind of?
There's some sort of layer, obviously with the tasting rooms, you can come in and hang out, like with breweries and do that kind of stuff. But honestly, that's kind of where the ABC kind of helps us, is we're controlled by a North Carolina company.
Yeah.
And so they love to push North Carolina products, North Carolina agriculture, everything like that. So there's some small thing. That's honestly why the main reason we moved onto this street.
Yeah.
High location.
Absolutely.
I'm out there.
Yeah, because then even if people can't come in and try the product or whatever,
exactly.
they can't buy you're here and they see you.
They can come by. I mean, I'll be open here making vodka at 6 o'clock in the evening. People walking to Gibbs, just stopping, oh, what's going on? You know, talking, and they love it, man. They love seeing there's that connection that people love and that we personally love that'll help them.
And you're right. There is sort of that fine line. We need to keep the excitement out there to keep in front of people to know what we're doing, but we're, for all intents and purposes, a production facility that we just need to make the product and get it on the ABC store shelves. But there's not a lot of social activity in that, and we enjoy social activity as well. So being on this street with the front door open, what are you laughing at over there? Andrew enjoys social activity. I'm an old curmudgeon. Being on the street, it's just a great mix of people. And with the different things that are getting ready to open here on the street, there's a lot going on down here with the Bearded Goat opening up at the end down there. Table 16, the boxcar across the way.
There's going to be a lot
going on.
That's awesome for this area because it's really been lacking. Like, the only thing down here is like Mellow and Gibbs.
That's right.
And really nothing has come.
Growing up, man, you didn't cross those tracks.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So that was kind of the thing that drew me back to this area. I was like, man, just being in this area was not fun 15 years ago, you know? So coming back here, I was like, this is awesome. Just exploring down here, these old buildings are gorgeous. Everybody's super nice back here. I love it.
Yeah, the HQ next door is really cool, too. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Oh, yeah. I was in there this morning for a meeting.
It's similar to this, like how your tasting room is.
It's awesome. It's the same guy who owns it, Andy Zimmerman. Owns
perfect.
I love the way they set it up over there, man. They've got some cool stuff.
Yeah, I'll have to go there sometime. It's really awesome.
It's nice.
Check that out.
Did you like that homebrew?
Yeah, it was good.
I'm gonna go get some more beer. Is there a beer out here?
He's going to grab some more beer.
So you said you were a homebrewer at one point.
I was, man. I homebrewed. At first, I used to buy, before I was 21. I used to buy those Mr. Beer homebrew kits.
Yeah.
Yes, I was like, man, I can do this. I can make all this. I don't have to worry about my fake ID going down. and then that just turned out poorly. I blew that like 8 times. I was like, all
right. Did they not ID you to buy beer kits? Is that?
I ordered online, so
okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
They didn't I don't know. I didn't open it before. I was trying
to put a hole in it now.
Yeah. No, but, yeah, I've wondered about that before.
Yeah, I don't know. That's what I was like. They were going to, like, in our dorm room, had it like in the closet.
That'll never find
it. It was, like,
it
was gross, yeah. and then I homebrewed a little bit, and honestly, it's weird now because I didn't have the patience like to sit there and like let it carbonate and like all that stuff, and now I'm putting whiskey in barrels for 20 years, you know?
Yeah, you're doing the ultimate.
Yeah, I know.
You're doing worse than like sour beers.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
But that's what we did because I was like homebrewing and stuff, and I was real big in craft beer, and then I had a desk job, and the longer I worked that desk job, the harder I needed something to drink.
Yeah.
And so I started moving into craft bourbon and stuff like that, and I was like, well, let's look into that. Let's see if you can just make that. And
yeah.
That's when it all kind of crossed over there.
That's awesome. So you brought up another good point. What's it like to have something come off the line, like, you know, like a whiskey, and then just look at it and be like, well, I'll see you again later, I guess.
The hard part is convincing the bank.
Yeah.
To say, oh yeah, we want to spend a lot of money over the next 4 years, but we won't have any sales with that.
Which is why you're doing the gin and the vodka.
Exactly, yeah.
Because that's your cash cow until you've got bourbon and
whiskey
and all that fun stuff.
With our hearts are always with whiskey. I'm a huge gin guy as well, though. The past couple years, I really got into it.
Gin's come a long way in the past. Gin and vodka both have come a long way.
Yeah.
Probably with the rise of people doing more craft distilling and stuff, but I've noticed there's been a lot more good vodkas with like a smoother finish on it coming out recently.
Yeah, yours was hella smooth.
Yeah, that was delicious.
Did you guys like that?
Yeah,
good.
Yeah,
man. We've been tweaking with that the past 2 weeks, man. So that's what we did today.
It's got kind of like a almost a really subtle sweetness to it too.
I call it, it's almost like creamy or buttery to me.
Yeah,
on the palate. Yeah,
yeah,
it's really round for a vodka personally, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because for me, like drinking, usually it's just like rubbing alcohol.
Yeah,
most of the vodka I drink.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
But think of the process. You have to take it to 190 proof.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I think when somebody asked me the other day the difference between a good vodka and a bad vodka, that if you have to take it to 190 proof, and I think the difference is where you cut the heads, hearts, and tails.
Yeah.
Because the heads have a certain taste to them that are less than complimentary, as do the tails, and there's a fine line of where the heart starts in the middle of the run. And it's his expertise that allows you to get enough of the head that you get some of that flavor in there and enough of the tail. But it's hard to spend a lot of money, make this product, and go, I'm not going to use this.
I'm
not going to
beat it
here
over there.
So the heads and the tails, is that what it catches above and below the boiling
point?
Yeah,
so I was about to say, I don't think we ever explained that.
Yeah.
So when it comes off out of the condenser, it all comes out that clear liquid. And then there's three parts of the run. So the first part comes off is the heads. It's called the heads. It's the really rubbing alcohol taste to it that you don't want to drink.
And like a fingernail polish remover.
Yeah.
And that's where some of that methanol comes out that you have to get rid of. Right?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
And it vaporizes at about 155 degrees. So it's the first thing to come off. So it's a matter of working that still and working that column to make sure that you concentrate all of that and then allow the heads to come off
and
get that out of the way.
And then that middle part is the part that you want, the hearts. That's the great taste that you come over with. The end is the tails, which is really low proof, but a lot of it's that dirty water taste.
Right.
So, you know, not enough alcohol is coming over. It's all boiling up too much where it's just that you burn off all the alcohol. You're getting just the gross water at that point.
But you have to get a little bit of the front, a little bit of the back.
Because that's where your ingredients are sitting.
And some of that mouthfeel that you get, the character of it.
Especially with the whiskey. A lot of that really melds well with the oak that you taste that you wouldn't do with like a vodka.
Yeah. So are there, like, in beer you can take any adjunct you want and theoretically just throw it in the beer, it'll come through on some level. Are there things that don't won't boil out at certain temperatures to come through in the liquor?
Not really. That you kind of play with. It's hard because, like, with gin. And so, like, we do two steps. We macerate the actual, I'll just call it vodka because it's pretty much vodka at that point. Before, when we put it in the still, we macerate. So it's, we put a giant tea bag in there full of all the botanicals and stuff right. like that. And so that's kind of the hard part with gin is it comes over at different points. Like, you'll get really strong star anise at the end for some reason, mm-hmm. and then really strong cucumber at the beginning. So you have to kind of meld it. That's kind of the hard part about making cuts with gin.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons we call our gin emulsion gin. That would be the name of our gin, is we're really making different products and then blending them together to get the exact flavor profile that we're looking for. That's and right. I go back to where if the laws change, where we can take then that gin that we have left over that we didn't use, we can reformulate to another type of gin that we might want to mellow in a bourbon barrel for a while or something like that.
Absolutely.
So we don't waste
anything.
That's
really cool. It seems like there's a lot of creativity then with the gin.
It is. Yeah, that's kind of the fun part about gin is you have to put predominantly juniper in there, everything else, do whatever you want, man.
Yeah.
And so that's what a lot of the fun craft distillers have been doing the past several years.
Did I say lemongrass?
You did say lemongrass. I have to cut that out now. I was excited about that lemongrass, too. It came out well. That's kind of the fun part. You can just do whatever you want. So, you know, some people just think gin, super Christmas tree, you know, beef eater that you had one bad night when you were 18. But, you know, when it comes out now, you can play with whatever you want. So, it's fun. It's almost like, when I smell it, it's almost like a chai tea, almost, with, like, juniper in there, some citrus. I really enjoy playing with that.
So, how do you taste liquors to you know, like a beer, you can sit down and you have a full beer, and it's not that much alcohol. But with, like, the liquor, or if you just take that tiny sip, are you getting the full palate that you need to be able to test that? Or
just do it in the morning so you can drive home.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we learned that we did not know 5 or 6 years ago is that you water it down before you taste it.
That was a big learning curve.
You
before don't know. It tastes good.
That's 190 proof.
Yeah.
That's great. You really want to take it down to your proof to see how you're going to put it in the bottle before you taste it. And it does take some inner strength to not just sit in front of the still all day and just drink.
Thank God for Uber. No, it is nice, though. I mean, because at first you take too strong, take too much, but then once you start making a repeatable process, you can hit that top of the palate, just round and say, that's perfect, that's what I need.
Right, because you're just looking for the differences between it and the last batch.
Exactly.
That's
exactly
right.
Full
flavor profile,
Yeah, so how do you guys deal with consistency? So are you, like, you have that product you like now, and then when you're trying the new stuff, do you kind of take the old stuff and kind of compare them side by side?
I'll tell you, we have a piece of equipment that comes from Anton Parr that is it's not just a proofer, but it's a spectrometer. It checks the color of something for us. And so we can create a repeatable product that says, okay, here's what is perfect for us, that we can take some of that, here's the way I taste it today, out of it. And it is really just a chemical process. You know, unlike beer or wine, if you do the same thing every single time, you should get the same result in the end. Now, there's a lot of his artistry that has to create some of that character in it to keep it that way.
Right, but you're iterating rather than trying to recreate and iterate at the same time.
That's exactly right.
And the still will fix a lot of things. So if something goes wrong with the mash, something happens, that you can finagle the still to come out certain degrees, certain way, say, I need this repeatable, sit there, and come out the same way.
Yeah.
In theory.
So we're told, yeah.
Yeah.
Seems like that's the part of the process that really takes the mastering. Really trying to
still doing
that.
It. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Because that vodka run takes 16 hours just to get the vodka out, but it's painstaking. But it is. Yep. It is.
So how long does it take from the time you grind up your grain to the time that it comes out in a drinkable form?
Well, it's kind of a loaded question because when we make vodka, we do because our still is so large and going running through 16 plates, we can't just take a mash and run it through those 16 plates. We have to do what's called stripping. So we're going to do, we'll take 10 mashes and we'll run them through the still and bring it out at about 70 proof.
So run it, but it evens out about that. You run it super hot and quick just so you just strip the alcohol
and you're essentially making moonshine.
Yeah.
And so we'll strip all of that out, put it in a 300-gallon tote. When we get about 600 gallons of that, then we'll start running it through and finessing it through the big still and making that. Because then it has enough energy to get all the way to the top. It's got enough alcohol in there. It's got enough oomph behind it to work. And so, you know, on paper, I would say from start to finish, we could make a vodka in 4 days. But
theoretically.
But there's a lot of things in between that make it. And that's just like talking about the heads and the tails. There are pieces of the heads and the tails that when we do the next run, we will put those back as a starter. Mm-hmm. And the next time we put a mash in the still, we'll put some of those heads and tails from before, because there's still some good hearts in there as well that this time when we run it through,
you'll be able to pull them out.
Yeah, we'll kind of pull it out. So when we say we get 35 gallons, 40 gallons of liquor off of every run, that evens itself out over a period of time.
Right.
That's what we should average off of there.
Writing so much.
Yeah, no, this is
stuff I didn't know.
Right.
This is more your forte.
Yeah.
You deal a little more with this.
I never got to the point of actually distilling anything, but I definitely built a still and learned a lot about the process.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But, so this is super interesting.
Yeah. We love it, man. It's a passion of ours that we love to share, because it is just like, it's new, you know? A lot of people know about beer and everything, how it's made, just because of the huge movement that it's made in the past 15 years.
Yeah. You feel like there's a lot of education happening about kind of what it is?
I think so. I think aficionados of spirits are beginning to understand the nuances between a true craft spirit and big manufacturers. The idea that, you know, we see distilleries that, I just saw one the other day, I'm not going to name the distillery, but they ran out of 12-year, and they just came out with more 12-year bourbon, which means they bought a 12-year bourbon from somebody else. And so that's how they got new 12-year bourbon. They didn't wait 12 years. Seeing distilleries that have been open 2 years and have a 12-year bourbon.
Yeah.
I think, again, there's not... It's what has happened all of the time, but people are beginning to want... People want to know what they're eating.
Yeah.
People want to know what they're drinking.
They're rising up.
Absolutely. Exactly. And they appreciate craft distillers.
Yeah. Do you guys feel a difference in the community that like a craft distiller would have, as opposed to like I guess, have you seen any pushback from like the black tie formal type of guys, or is it a very different community, or is there some crossover?
There's been somewhat of a little bit of pushback, but I have been overwhelmingly surprised by how much we've been embraced by the city, how quickly they wanted to get us through. They were so excited about
The city was great.
Oh man. I mean, the only thing was they'd never done distillery before, so you know, some things pop up that they didn't know, we didn't know, we needed to do this kind of thing. But that was it, man.
There was one person I remember walking by the front, and they looked at our sign, and all they said to each other was, "Oh, this is not what we need in Greensboro."
But that's
few and far between, I think.
Yeah.
We punched him.
Yeah, exactly.
Threw him in the
dumpster. Exactly.
In the cement truck now.
Yeah.
And Augie, I sent Augie after
him. She's vicious.
Do you guys have, so when you're making, I don't know much, you know, obviously you're not a market yet, right?
Right.
Okay. When you're making a gin, is that typically going to be something that like more of a gin person is going to look for it than somebody who's like a vodka person, or do people kind of try out everything?
That's kind of that's why we put the Fainting Goat, the same tag on every single bottle that we have. So you guys know that's, you know, because everything's going to have a different name kind of thing. So everyone that's traced back to.
And in North Carolina, they're separated out by alcohol type.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
So like if you go in and say, oh, I like their vodka, maybe try their gin. Our gin in particular, I wouldn't call it a starter gin. But it's not the high juniper flavor that most just super London dry style. That it's really palatable, that a lot of people enjoy. Best kind of thing is, you know, they're a vodka drinker. If you're just buying vodka, you may not be buying our 20-year-old Scott or our 20-year-old smoked single malt as well. But there's definitely some crossover there, and that's kind of what we want to expose people to.
I think there will be a lot of people who are just excited to try a North Carolina or a Greensboro product.
Oh, definitely.
One of the things that we're going to do is there's a new ABC store opening up
on Market
in October, something
like that.
So we'll be there signing bottles and things
that's
like
awesome.
That. Yeah, so
that's great.
There's a lot of that kind of excitement about the product and people just wanting to try. I heard somebody the other day said that they went in, and one of the guys from next door said they went to the liquor store and asked for this Greensboro product, and the guy said, "You're about the 100th person that has asked me for this stuff."
That's fantastic.
Yeah. That's great. And like I say, we went to the, and this week is the ABC convention here in town. We went to the ABC board conference about 6 months ago, and that's where all of the ABC store managers and all of the folks from the uppity ups from ABC were there, and they were all embracing the product. So we can't wait to get a North Carolina product. And,
yeah.
Just please don't be moonshine, is what they
said. Yeah, they said no, don't be moonshine. It's difficult to sell. Not that there's anything wrong with moonshine.
And that's the kind of thing with the crossover as well is, you know, if you just drink vodka, you see us on the shelf too with a bourbon. You say, I might want to try a bourbon, just kind of see what it's like. I've gotten a lot of people myself that, like my girlfriend hated whiskey 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I went through this journey. She's like, all right, I guess I'll try this, And now that's all she drinks, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of
a lush.
Yeah.
And you guys definitely do have the advantage. Most of the big name companies will let you focus on one style of spirit. Mm-hmm.
They tend to, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It gives us a lot of freedom to experiment with things. And with the different stills, we have one still that's a 300-gallon still, so that'll put off about 300 bottles every time we run it.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also have a 60-gallon still that we can do experimental things with. So when we are doing the absinthe or the, we want to do a proximity Canadian or rye or something like that. No,
not Canadian.
Not Canadian. All right.
Sounds illegal.
I'm
excited about that Christmas whiskey, though. That's what I want.
Then we can do small batches like that as well.
Yeah, I'm excited for like the smaller stuff that you guys were talking about, like throwing apples and other crazy stuff in there. That sounds awesome.
What you really want to try is the stuff that he'll have in his office.
Yeah.
So how does that stuff work, like with legally speaking? Like if you're doing something small batch that's... too small to sell, like that, they're totally cool with you guys just kind of iterating and doing small recipes, or?
Shelly? Well, we have to have,
if we sell it here, we have to be able to be available in ABC stores.
Okay.
And so if we could have 50 bottles, but if they pull in an order for 50 bottles, we can't sell it here.
Right.
Does that kind of make sense?
Okay.
And so that's kind of the way it works.
Really?
That's a weird thing, too, because I'm dealing with that at work. I think as long as it's taxable, that's the big thing.
Yeah, and it's taxable.
It is taxable. They just want their money.
Yeah,
they don't care really too much about it.
Right. And Shelly's the one that really kind of keeps up with all of the legalities.
She keeps us out of prison.
Yeah.
So far.
That's always
going.
Yeah.
She's 51. That's a tough job.
Yeah. She's 51%, so she's always going to be the one.
Yeah.
I have to track all of the
You were doing the Lord's work.
You talk about reporting. I'm not sure how it is in y'all's industry, but you know what they end up doing is they look at, we say, I'm using 600 pounds of grain, and that will produce about 300 bottles. They're going to start looking at, all right, you use 900 pounds of grain. Where are the bottles here? You brought in 2,400. We talked today. We were working with something out front, and something overflowed and was spilling out, and we said, how are we going to track that? How are we going to say I poured 2 gallons of vodka out accidentally?
Yeah.
There's just a lot.
That's tough. Gotta
keep bringing that up.
If the TTB is listening, we're doing the best we can. We're trying to be legal in everything that we do.
You're good.
Okay. Oh, God.
Yeah, I think you could just report that as loss.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they said, and we in a class we were in recently, you know, the question was, how much loss can you have? And as long as you are being honest and legal about it, you can't say I'm losing 300 bottles a day, but shit will happen in every day.
I think that's like when I worked at Natty, it's like if you dumped a batch, you had to report it as waste, and then you don't have to pay taxes on it.
Yeah, and just put it right in the back of my truck.
Yeah.
I'll waste something. Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm having a waste party.
But we did fill 50 extra kegs somehow. I don't know.
Who knows?
Weird.
Science.
Do you ever feel any damper on the creative part because of the legality of things with the actual distilling process, or is that more just on getting it into people's hands and like you're saying with the tasting room?
Which part? Are you talking about the creative on like making the whiskey?
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Like
I guess
smaller batch
stuff. However you want to answer it, but yeah. I was kind of asking, like, do you feel any pressure on how you can be creative in the actual distillery as opposed to like with brandy?
Somewhat. It's kind of weird because like with bourbon and like rye whiskey, there are strict laws that you have to follow to be called a bourbon or a rye whiskey,
mm-hmm.
which is good. So somebody can't just go pick up a bottle that says bourbon on it and it's not even close to what they want. But you know, there's some restrictions there, but that's kind of thing with like the small bottles. Like we can make, I dream about plum brandies and Christmas whiskeys and just everything that kind of goes through, so much you can play with. I can't really sell it just here, you know?
Yeah.
So I can't make 3,000 bottles of it to send out to Raleigh to sell. So there's some restrictions, but not too much. Like, they're not really inhibiting us too much.
That's
at that
good.
Point.
I think most of the restrictions that we feel are the time-consuming part of it, of being able to say, okay, we're ready to start selling. Oh, gosh, we got to wait another month or 6 weeks to get this label approved.
It's not like we can just put it in a keg, like a tap room. You want to experimental, put it in a keg, throw it out on Saturday and see what happens.
That's actually what I'm going to start doing at work.
That's awesome.
So I hope so.
Yeah. Okay, good.
I think, well, you're still reporting it as tax, so it's still a sellable good.
But
so
with us, we have to do
branding.
We have to do an entire label, entire product.
Yeah. I'm not selling it out of my tap room.
Exactly.
Right. So I don't have to have labeling.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So for us, if we were going to take our vodka and do a vanilla vodka, which we are not, it is completely, you have to go through the entire process again in order to do that.
Entire new label.
Yeah, because you guys can't sell it here.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
But can you do like small batch stuff like that and put it out in market?
We could do small batch stuff like that, but we'd have to get the labels approved.
Yeah,
get our labels.
If you wanted to.
And we could sell it here only in a sense that could be the bottle that you purchased a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the we scan their driver's license when they come in.
I was just about to ask how you keep track of that.
It's up to us to keep track of it.
Yeah.
According to
law. So it'll say, oh, you have 364 more days until you can buy another bottle from us.
Some people do just spreadsheets with the names in there and stuff like that.
That's
driver's license number.
That is.
Do they report? Do they like come back to you in a year and be like, give us all the names?
No, they will do audits, though. They'll check on
it.
And they also send a lot of undercover people this back, because it's a brand new law.
Yeah.
And so there's undercover people going in trying to
buy
two. So they'll get one
last
or two. They'll come in a second time.
So,
yeah.
So which direction did the law go? Was that restrictive or was that...
That was huge. I mean, before, you couldn't buy a bottle at a distillery.
You could
the only place you could do it was the ABC.
Yeah.
So that was huge for them to say, okay, you can buy one bottle per person per year. And I'm hoping that next step of one bottle of each thing we sell, that's the thing that's going to open up our creativity to be
absolutely.
Able to have the things here and have a market.
That's definitely
for them.
A good direction to go, because it also helps distilleries become a... vacation stuff, like a tourist stop.
Yeah. And it is part of the North Carolina Tourism Board has a passport, distillery passport, where you can go in and you all of the distilleries are listed and you stamp each one as you go kind of thing. So the Department of Agriculture and Tourism is becoming involved in distilleries.
That's
and recognizing what a big draw they are, because yes, it's local, certainly, in Greensboro and using all the North Carolina products, but you know, people that are drawn to and passionate and discriminating, is that the right word?
Doesn't sound right.
That doesn't sound right. I didn't say you people did.
That's like the fifth time this happened.
But they, you know, they'll get in their car on a Sunday and say, I'm going to go visit two distilleries, and they'll drive 200 miles to go visit distilleries.
And then you come back with a souvenir from your trip.
That's exactly right.
Have you guys, I don't know how, I assume distilling in North Carolina, craft distilling in North Carolina seems like it's definitely on the rise. I'm not sure how big it is as a whole. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in beer, you see relationships being built across the state. Are you guys seeing that? Or are other people, like, open to that? Or is it...
Within the state?
Within the state.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah?
It's been awesome.
Yeah.
Even in general, the craft distilling, it's just a brotherhood almost.
Right.
Like, I was having trouble with this vodka the other day. I got on, there's a forum that if you're a distiller.
Institute.
Yeah. If you're a member there, they have a forum there. I got on there, hit up a guy, goes, I just won best in class on vodka. Let me tell you exactly what you're doing.
And I use your same still.
That seems like it's even more embracing than beer is.
Exactly.
That's great.
Or even like our grain today. We were having a problem getting grain. I knew a guy in Charlotte that does it. I met him about a year ago who's been really helpful with us. I talked to him. He called me. He's like, hey, I actually have too much grain. Our farmer has too much grain. You guys interested? Let's take 6 tons tomorrow if you want. So, I mean, it's really just everybody looks out for each other, helps each other. I mean, technically we're competitors, sure, but I mean, there's room
but
for
still,
everybody.
It's still,
it's just like beer.
Yeah.
It's still rising tides. It's not anywhere
exactly,
near market saturation.
And even with beer, I know you guys are super close, like all the brewer stuff, and then they reach out to us and help us. If we have a mashing problem, I'll ask somebody there. I'm like, oh, yeah, you're just doing this, add this, and you know you're done. But it's awesome.
Have you guys learned things about your, I guess let me rephrase it. What types of things have you guys learned about your process from a beer perspective that maybe you didn't know coming into it, anything like that, or is it more just general, this is how you make alcohol, you know?
You're looking at me like I'm supposed to answer that question.
You do the mashing. That's the problem is we don't make a great beer.
We won't make a great beer. Yeah.
There's no way in hell I would ever sell that beer.
No, and when we first started up, there were a lot of brewers that would come to us and say, tell me what kind of yeast you're using.
Yeah.
And I said, yeast is unimportant to
about
me.
$300
and they're like,
less
oh my God, what are you saying? Because that's an important part of your process.
Like, when you're done ferment, like 3 days, like, wait, what?
I've seen that stuff at the homebrew shop, like turbo yeast.
Is not turbo yeast.
But
that stuff goes nuts.
But that does
go
nuts.
But, there are nuances that are different. So, brewers tend to look at us and think, are you sure you know what you're doing? But at the end, we're doing something different with that beer.
Yeah.
So,
in
the end, we'll get something good out of it.
And I'm sure, when brewers come in, they're, cringing at, sanitation and stuff.
Oh, why
do you have that open? Why are you wearing gloves and stuff? What are you doing?
Why is there sweat dripping?
Yeah. It's the same process it goes through to make water safe to drink.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not pretty.
So how much, I guess, excuse me, I'm trying to learn and figure things out. So how much of the flavor do you guys dictate by the mash as opposed to distilling?
It depends on the product itself.
Okay.
So for the things that are going to come off the still at a lower proof, like the whiskeys, a lot of that is dictated by the recipe of the mash itself. However, I can't say enough, a lot of that is based on being able to store it in the right barrel, in the right temperature, for the right amount of time.
Okay.
It really is what makes, brings out all of the character that we've created in
that you recognize whiskey as.
Yeah, it's the velvet, the mouthfeel, the thickness, the caramel, the viscosity of it. All of that comes from the right barrel at the right temperature for the right length of time.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, if you sit and drink a bourbon versus a rye whiskey, there's going to be a difference in the recipe itself that's going to create those. And that's where it does come from the mash.
Yeah. Okay.
I've got a very simple philosophy as if you put shit in the still, you're going to get shit out of the still.
Yeah,
you know what
sure.
I mean? That's, yeah. So the mashes are incredibly important, which a lot of distillers don't take as serious.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when my homebrewing background and his, by far, his chef experience, executive chef experience, kind of helped us out at that point, take it to that next level there.
He said that to me the other day about the shit in and shit out.
I've said it quite
a
bit to him.
It makes complete sense.
It does make sense.
Maybe in a more negative way.
In beer terms, if you have your mash at 170 degrees, you're killing all your enzymes. There's shit right there.
Exactly.
You throw it in the kettle, you're going to have shit. You're not going to, it's not going to ferment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where do you guys get your barrels from?
Those out there are from a cooperage out of Missouri called
Higbee.
53 Barrels.
Barrel 53 cooperage from Higbee, Missouri.
Yeah. That was a 2-year waiting list.
That's
probably a harder list to get on nowadays.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We signed up for that a little over 2 years ago, and we're struggling to figure out whether we were going to be able to get barrels in time. Now that we're in that rotation with them, it's going to be much easier for us. And I've said, if we'd have done it differently, maybe being a cooper would have been
a more profitable way.
Making barrels, because that's, with the laws the way they are, again, they have to be brand new barrels each time.
Right.
Yeah.
It puts some limitations on you storage-wise, but certainly, as a small player, when I order 24 barrels, that's a big order for me because they're $400 or $500 each to order 24 barrels.
24,000 in a day.
Yeah, so they're not concerned about me needing barrels.
So how much I work in multimedia production.
Okay.
And so a lot of my job is trying to make sure that things come in at the right time, and that can be incredibly stressful. And if you guys are doing stuff that's taken like 2 years that needs to line up at the right time, like how difficult is that to make sure that like, oh, well, we have to get these barrels. These are on a 2 year wait list, but then we have this other stuff sitting over here. Like how hard is it to get that organized for a production schedule?
It's mostly Shelly's job.
Yeah.
So when we changed locations, it was a real problem.
Yeah, because we were looking at a different location at one point and had begun renovation on it before we found
and
this spot.
Started the application at that address.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So we had to stop and start that application over again. But really, for the most part, they are the consumables are easy to get. The barrels and then the grain are the two hardest things because the grain are so dependent upon, was there enough rain this year to get enough grain?
Yeah.
Especially when we use just North Carolina grain.
Absolutely.
If one farmer has a problem, they all
have
a problem that
year. Exactly
right. That's right. Like, oh, my God.
Yeah, they were talking about rye today.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a difficult year for rye. So we had to commit to the rest of our year's worth of rye in order to take what's going.
Or you go to Canada where it's plentiful and get
That's actually something else that's interesting about it being local, too, though, is you do taste some of the state in the product because of the quality changes. You know, it's like wines have years.
That's exactly right. And specific soil produces specific things. And in Kentucky, the specific limestone creates the water. I think that you will see a really unique North Carolina taste that may be recognizable in one way or another. It might be, oh, that tastes like the water that I used to drink, or that tastes like something.
That's kind of part you just kind of pivot on, though, when you're at that point.
Yeah.
Like, we're low on wheat. All right, sounds like we're making a lot of bourbon this week.
Yeah.
You know, throw it in there.
Yeah. Yeah. We made a lot of single malt whiskey.
Yeah,
the
there's a lot of single malt.
We were struggling trying to find wheat.
Two row was plentiful, but wheat was not.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much can you, so like another thing that seems simpler with beer for me, I might be mistaken, is if I drink this beer and then I drink a different beer, as somebody who knows the brewing process, it's really easy to pinpoint the things, but in distilling, a lot of that stuff isn't as transparent. So can you take influence from other people's spirits, or how much?
I mean, the
smile on your face.
knowing what we know about the industry, certainly a huge percentage of the spirits that are out there are produced by one person, MGP, or what's the other place, True Blue, or
Ultra Pure.
So, however, knowing that that's a huge part of the market, we know that that's sort of the baseline for what people think. That's what it's supposed to taste
okay,
like.
Okay, yeah.
So we can take that and then put our play on that. I know that in bourbon, think about the different types of bourbon, whether it's a wheated or a rye or whatever. I know that there's a baseline of bourbon that we like, but Andrew likes a spicy bourbon with a little bit more rye in it. So we can take that baseline that we know is generally accepted or by most of the population, and then put our unique spin on that.
It's interesting. Yeah, I never thought about that. Because, like I said, 70% of liquor is not made at the same place as bottled.
Yeah.
I think that was ADI's last percentage in overall craft distilling. And so a lot, like whiskey-wise, most of it comes from MGP out of Lawrenceville, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the ryes and I think mostly ryes right now are coming from Canada.
And a lot of the vodka, too.
Yeah.
And much of the vodka, the grain neutral spirits are corn based as well, because that's the easiest thing to work with.
Absolutely.
And the cheapest to work with, certainly. But you will have certainly his influence on Andrew's influence on here's what I like as a mouthfeel of a bourbon, and here's what ours is going to taste like.
Yeah.
You know, at one point we were talking about making just a shit bourbon. And just calling it "Get Off of My Lawn." That would be a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
But he could not pull himself together. cheap bourbon.
Another thing we've seen in beer that seems like craft liquor could be just right on the surface of doing is the expansion of styles. So you have one style blow up and then it starts to expand and stuff like that. But I guess in spirits you can't take a certain whiskey, and if it's a bourbon, it's a bourbon. You can't call it a different kind of bourbon.
Right.
You know, so do you guys see
styles.
Room to be able to expand styles? Or?
There's been somewhat. Rye whiskey has got a huge renaissance the past couple of years. Bartenders love it and have been working well with it. The gin is what I see a big one on, is New American gin. Nobody really made 5 years ago, and now it's super
gin
hot.
Gin is blowing up.
Gin is huge.
Everybody's doing gin.
Yeah. That's good. And that's kind of thing is they're small. And that's when you start playing with liqueurs or digestive, stuff like that you can kind of play with.
But it's like driving a ship, though. If you think about, you know, bourbon 20 years ago had a huge decline.
Yeah.
And so it's taken 20 years to get enough bourbon to come back because it's not like you can just ship bourbon out.
Yeah.
You got to get it made.
Because we've just now in the past, 6 or 7 years really starting to see bourbon become what it is.
Like 200% a year or something crazy like that. Yeah.
Is the, I guess you guys haven't been doing it, you know, very long, obviously.
Legally.
But
yeah.
In production.
Yes.
But
under God's watchful eye.
How, from talking to people, how difficult is it to predict trends? Like, are people pretty open about what they're doing so you can talk to people about, like, what they're doing to kind of see trends? Or is it more consumer-defined?
I mean, it depends. I always see things that they say are going to be trends in 6 years and just never show up.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I kind of stay true to ourselves. Do what we like to do. Do what we enjoy to taste. Stay true to yourself. When it comes out, hopefully in the end, it'll become a trend at some point. People will like it and click on. But just kind of stay true to yourself. We don't like to click on a certain or hold on to certain trends and just kind of ride that wave.
Absolutely.
You know, stay true. Yeah, it looked like you had something to add to that.
No.
23-year-old bourbon will always stay in trend.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
That's true.
And we'll be there 23 years from now.
God willing.
Well, since people can't buy your product yet, and I hope everybody does as soon as it becomes available.
Middle of August.
What do you guys sip on? What do you like?
Oh, that's a tough one, man. I'm never one for favorites. And my taste will change. Like, I'll be all over.
What's something that might be unique to people listening?
One of my favorite whiskeys for the past 5 years is Blanton's.
Yeah.
If you get your hands on it, it's a couple in Greensboro that a couple ABC stores sell it. That's by far my favorite. A higher rye content. Basil Hayden is one I recommend to everybody.
Basil Hayden's great.
Yeah.
That's one I bring to a party every time because nobody doesn't like Basil Hayden.
Yeah.
You can't turn it down. That's still a higher rye content as well. It depends on each category.
Yeah. I like Michter's, and I hate to say that because I know that Michter's is sometimes contracted other places as well. There was an Old Forester that just came out that's a unique label to the Old Forester that, you know, it's typically $20-something dollars a bottle. This one's $44. It's just a really good good bourbon as well. Elijah Craig. Shelley likes Elijah Craig a lot. When we were in Kentucky, we got a 23-year-old Elijah Craig that was a really good bottle of bourbon. And rye whiskeys. I think we're beginning to all see. For me, I would say that 5 years ago, I'd had 3 brown liquors in my entire life. I was just not a brown liquor drinker.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up doing that. I was a vodka.
Forced it down his throat a little bit.
So vodka. I drank a lot of vodka, a lot of gin, a lot of wine, a lot of beer. But didn't, you know, the last 5 years, there's been a lot of bourbon past my lips.
Ooh. I noticed you guys didn't talk about rum. Have you thought about doing rum at all, or is that not a...
rum is interesting.
Yeah.
It is incredibly messy to make.
Because it's based on simple sugar.
Molasses or sugar, whatever you want to use.
Because that's how I always separate it out, is, you know, like a vodka is generally a starch-based.
Yeah.
A whiskey is more of a carbohydrate-based, and then a rum is generally like a simple sugar, right?
Right. Molasses, typically the cane sugar that they would use for it. We'll be careful answering that question. First of all, we've never been rum drinkers. I think that's the biggest part of it. We were not drawn to that.
Yeah.
And so we kind of thought, as an afterthought, we might do some rum, but that's not what makes us happy.
Yeah, so let's do what we want.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Let's do what we do now.
It's also a little easier to make.
Yeah, that's what I was trying not to say.
Yeah.
There are rum makers out there are going to jump all over you.
That makes sense.
I mean, don't get me wrong, it's still a hard process to make.
And there's
great
a point
rum out
where you can kind of tell there are rums that have a lot of complexity to them.
Yeah.
Lower end rums tend to just be kind of decent liquor that.
That's exactly
kind
right.
of
yeah. that you can add something to
yeah.
To get a little kick.
Yeah.
I'm not counting out doing rum in the future. It's probably one of the later things I would jump on.
And especially if we import that from Haiti, then we have a base to sort of play with to create different takes on what we would see rum as. I mean, rum in a bourbon barrel would be absolutely fantastic.
Rum is huge right now, too.
Oh, yeah.
They're taking over with the whiskey shortage.
Yeah.
I went to a rum bar in San Francisco, just won Bar of the Year in New Orleans this weekend. Yeah. And they're killing it.
So 6 years from now, we're going to listen to this and go, God damn it. How are we making rum? What is it, Queen Charlotte? Muddy River's aged rum is really good.
Yeah.
I actually enjoy that.
Yeah. How long do you have to actually age rum?
They don't have an age limit.
So, I mean, it's done.
Yeah. You can have a 6 year, you can have a 20 year, you can have a 2 month one if you want.
Yeah. And, cool. And can you also add wood to the rum while it's
I think so. But I don't want to.
Yeah, I think it's got the same sort of designation as whiskey. Yeah. That you put it in a barrel to make it brown and mellow it out a little bit.
Yeah.
And like you could get some wood character. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the aged ones. I think that somebody does a spice rum around here. It's pretty good too.
Mm.
We're all looking at the clock.
There's numbers going on.
Yeah.
Is a shot clock going on?
Nah.
Shoot!
It's climbing up.
Oh.
So, are you guys on social media? How can people find you?
We are, man. Instagram and Twitter, we're Fainting Goat Spirits. Facebook, we're Greensboro Distilling Company. That one will get transitioned into the Fainting Goat Spirits brand. But we post on there all the time. Love doing the production in there. There's a lot of stuff on Instagram. Just gets Facebook, Twitter.
Websites are faintinggoatspirits.com and greensboro distilling.com. You can go in and sign up and join the spirited.
Yep.
That way you'll be on the list for, we're getting ready to bottle, we're getting ready to do this. That's a great way to stay involved with what we're doing as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're kind of wrapping up, but one last question, because I didn't think to ask, is where did the name come from?
So we're a family-owned business.
Yeah.
So it's Andrew's my son,
yeah.
Myself, my wife Shelley, our daughter Leslie. Have you ever seen a fainting goat?
I have not in person.
Yeah, fainting goats have myotonic spasticity, which means that they, when they get adrenaline, they're excited or scared, they just freeze and fall over with their feet up in the air. They're sort of an oddity in the animal kingdom. They frighten the hell out of the other goats, but they're kind of okay with who they are. And that kind of describes us as a family. We're a little bit out there. We're okay with what we do, but we scare other people sometimes. But we're sort of an oddity. Yeah, there are times where we fall down with our feet up in the air, too. Almost today. It makes us laugh, too.
Yeah.
It just makes us laugh.
If you're not doing something with a smile on your face, why are you doing it, right?
Yeah.
There's something behind it, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's awesome.
Hell yeah.
Cool.
I like the name.
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, you bet.
Thank you for having us,
man. Super enlightening talk.
I learned a lot.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know.
It's crazy how similar and yet how uniquely different it is.
It is.
In the beer industry.
Yeah. Like football and Australian rules football.
It's the same principles. No. They're just doing it a little different.
Rugby?
Rugby football?
There's something there.
Maybe. Yeah.
I still don't understand
that game.
Let me
think on that.
Yeah.
Let me think on that.
Well, as always, we are crafted for you. You can check us out on Facebook, Instagram. Wow, your fiance normally does this.
Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Untapped. Crafted for, or CFYpodcast.com.
There you go.
We're on iTunes.
Yes, please listen, rate, subscribe.
iTunes is the big one.
Oh, cool.
iTunes is big.
Yeah.
Anywhere, wherever you listen to podcasts, if you listen to podcasts,
we are there.
We are there. So cheers.
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 Cheers.